Welcome to the Capital Connection, a weekly program questioning New York State leaders on a variety of issues. Your host is Dr. Alan Chartok, political scientist and professor emeritus at the University at Albany. Distribution of the Capital Connection is made possible with the help of New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare, online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.
Welcome to the Capital Connection. I'm Alan Chartok. Joining us is New York State Assembly Majority Leader Ron Canestrari, a Democrat who has represented the 106th District since 1989. Canestrari has announced that he will not seek re-election, meaning 2012 will be his last in the legislature. Majority Leader Canestrari, our old friend here at WAMC, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
Well, how can you be in the legislature that long and just decide to leave? Doesn't seem right somehow. Everybody knows you. Everybody likes you. What's that about?
Well, 24 years is a long time, and it's a total of 37 years, actually, in office with my previous position as mayor of the city of Cohoes, my hometown. And the clock is ticking. The things I want to do in terms of trips and traveling, and I don't want to postpone that next trip. I want to do it when I want to do it.
Where do you want to go?
Well,
what's
list.
So important?
There's a list. Italy always beckons, but I sure. still do that a couple of times a year anyway. But Tibet and Nepal are on the list, as well as the Canadian Rockies and some of our national parks that I haven't seen. And so there are places to go.
So, Ron Canestrari, when you go to Tibet and Nepal, you'll go to see the great guru at the top of the hill, and you'll ask him the secret of life.
I already know. I have that secret pretty well down. But.
And what is that?
We
can't share it.
Yeah, that's kind of private.
So, okay, tell us about the legislature. Now that you're leaving, you can tell all. What kind of a place? How would you describe it? Somebody comes up and you say, okay, Ron, what's the legislature really like? What would you say?
Well, number one, it's a great place. The Assembly, I've loved what I've been doing for these more than two decades. A lot of good people. Unfortunately, some of the few that get in trouble cast a pall and suspicion over the most of us, the majority of us. But that's life. When you accept it, it's a political atmosphere. But it's a great place to work, to get things done, and to work with some real good people as well.
Well, you've known some of the few, and you're right, few bad apples. What makes them act so stupidly?
I know. It makes you wonder. And it's just not legislators. You look at Governor Spitzer.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
People who are bright, who are intelligent, that do stupid things. I think it's the arrogance. They get carried away with their position and thinking they're smarter than everyone else and nothing can touch me because I'm important and I'm special. When, of course, that is not the case and it shouldn't be the case.
Are you satisfied with the way that your leader, Shelley Silver, has been running the legislature?
Absolutely. Yes, I am. He still and remains to be the smartest guy on the Hill.
I take it that includes the governor?
Oh, yeah. I think he's the smartest man up there, really. He is brilliant, a tactician, a person who knows the details of issues. You know, previous speakers, and they were all bright people, would rely on staff to, you know, intricacies of whether it's Medicaid, Medicare, home health care. The Speaker of the Assembly knows all this stuff in terms of information. So there's information he knows, there's institutional knowledge that he has, and just a strategy man. He does some good things for the people of the state.
So I knew a newspaper editor once who left. And on his way out, he said, I'm really worried because I don't know if people will like me now that I don't have power. Does that ever cross your mind?
Oh, I think it'll happen. I really do. I think,
you think
once you're out,
know.
You're out. Yeah. Your history. And that's, you know, something I'll deal with, but I expect it. True friends are true friends, but the phone that rings, people looking for jobs won't be doing that anymore. And but that's the nature of the beast. And once you're out of office, I think it changes dramatically.
Yeah. So let me ask you about the thought that maybe there's a new cadre of younger guys coming up at the bottom and that they're getting impatient. You know, Shelley's getting older. You're still a very young man at 69, but Shelley's getting older. That maybe it's time to let some of the younger guys into the upper echelons. What do you think about that?
Well, certainly seniority plays a key in any legislative body, and it plays a key in the assembly that has a role. So there's a natural order of progression. When people move out, including myself, the Speaker pro tem is leaving. We're both senior members in terms of service and age.
Who's the Speaker pro tem for
those? Peter Rivera from the Bronx. So there's a natural process, and the more senior people move up, and it's changing, and they're getting younger all across the board, and that's just the way it should be.
I want to go to something substantive, which we've been talking about on this program for a long, long time, and that's the concept of redistricting. The legislature, who wouldn't? If you're in the majority party, you'd like to draw your own lines, and that continues to rankle some. What do you make of that controversy?
Well, I think it plays to a very limited audience, to be honest. Mm-hmm. Those that are interested in the governmental process, I believe the average New Yorker, I think, is not that interested in it. And I believe we in the Assembly do it well. I'm a proponent of the way we do it. We are very careful both with the Department of Justice and court cases to ensure we do it the right way. The courts allow some protection for incumbents. We do some protection, but we don't overdo it. And we get sued. We always win in general because we do it the right way. We do it very carefully, very scientifically. And I don't think there is any such thing as an independent commission out there. Who appoints a commission? What will their interest be in something so critically important to us as legislators? I believe we should have a handle in doing it and getting it done every 10 years, as long as it's done right, legally, and politically acceptable.
So let's go, Ron Canestrari, from the Assembly to the Senate. Now, you got a proposition. You got a state made up primarily of Democrats. You've got a group of people who are hanging on for dear life, the Republicans in the state Senate. You said you did it right. They've played every card they can. They've put an extra district in to give themselves, an advantage. They've got an aging group, but they are trying very hard. And they maintain a one-vote margin, there. That doesn't seem right. I mean, we send our kids, I'm sorry to go on so long, but we send our kids to Afghanistan to fight for, quote, democracy. And yet we don't let Steinbrenner umpire the Yankee games. And why in the world would we allow this kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't like what the Senate did with the creation of that new district. It just looks suspicious, and it is what it is, the power grab. We'll see whether the courts uphold it. It has been upheld initially, and we'll see on appeal whether it stays. I wouldn't have done it that way, but that, of course, I'm not involved with that end of it from the Senate's perspective. But I also think, even with redistricting, the houses have changed power in redistricting years, because the demographics and the appeal of candidates override to a large extent, to some extent, the district lines that are drawn. And we've lost when the redistricting has been done. Majorities of minority have lost. So the popular will and the popular vote is still out there, and that's still crucial.
Well, Ron Canestrari, along is going to come an election in which I suspect that President Obama is going to do very well in New York State. With all of the mechanics of changing districts around in the other party, in the other House, it is conceivable that if a lot of Democrats show up to vote, that there could be a tidal wave. We've seen it before in the Goldwater election. We've seen it. Could it happen?
Yes, it could. It could happen. I think Obama will do very well here. I'm a little worried nationally, but he'll do very well in New York State. And I believe people will come out in droves. And yes, the Senate could change, even with the lines drawn as the way they are. And some of the members are very, very old and up there. And people may think it's time for a change in those individual senatorial districts as well. And the Democrats could come back again in the Senate.
2016. I mean, we're not even up to this election, but everybody's talking about 2016. And New York.
Not me.
The older we get, the less we like to go that far in advance. But there is this fascinating thing going on in New York. Almost everybody believes that Andrew Cuomo, the governor, has done well enough so that he intends to run in 2016 for president. Now we see polls that saying, it's a joke if one compares him to Hillary Clinton, who has, this huge number of voters, and he's got 5%, in the United States. This is unique to New York. We haven't had this kind of attention for a long time. What do you think?
I think, regardless of who it is, it's hard to elect a Democratic president from New York State. The rest of the country perceives us as a little bit out there. Maybe they're right in some ways. And I think it's a heavy lift for a New Yorker and a New Yorker to become president.
Yes, but that's not exactly where I was going.
I was going
to this competition between these two people, you know, Andrew and Hillary. You know, I saw that Senator Gillibrand, let me try it this way. Senator Gillibrand announced one day out of nowhere that she was going to be the first signatory to the Hillary in 2016 election. And I was saying to myself, well, I know Andrew Cuomo well enough to know he, as we say in the colloquial, ain't going to like this. I can just imagine the fume coming out of his head. Do you think that Hillary is a real possible candidate for president?
I don't. I don't think so. As much as I like to see it, because I'm a Hillary fan and was the last presidential election and think she was a great senator for us, always available, and has done an excellent job as Secretary of State. But she's announced this when the president's term is up, she will not continue to serve, is going to fade into the sunset.
And then she won't campaign for him.
And she won't campaign for him. That surprised me a bit, to be honest.
So I had to look for a reason for that.
Yeah. And what is your reason?
Well, thank you for interviewing me, but I thought that the potential reason was that she intended to run for president. And if she runs for president, then she doesn't want to get involved in a political campaign now. She wants to maintain that sort of aloofness. I think it's a sign she might run.
See, I think it's a line almost the opposite, because if she could campaign for the sitting president, and if he wins, she's ingratiated herself around the country campaigning, which is never harmful. And if he doesn't win, she's even become more of someone of the Obama clan, the Obama fans that felt Hillary did her best for us. It didn't work out. And they're appreciative of that, as opposed to her sitting on the sidelines. And if he goes down, she could incur some bad feelings from the Obama camp, shall we say.
And that, my friend, is why you're the majority leader. I'm not.
But not for much longer.
makes perfect amount of sense. A group of well-heeled New Yorkers, David Rockefeller and others, have come up with the idea that we should have campaign financing in New York. And that what New York City has, and they have it, I think, because they have a plebiscite system down there. They can vote it in. We don't have one in New York State. That we should have campaign financing. What do you make of that?
I agree with them. I really do. I think on the national level and state level, the influence of money is out of control. I read that Romney wants to raise $800 million, and Obama will probably do as well. This is out of control. But that's the federal level. The state level, yes, we should do something here. Limited eye support, similar to New York City, a limited public financing of campaigns, meaning a candidate who can raise X dollars could get matching funds, and that sort of a structure. I would support that completely. I believe it's a step in the right direction.
And the chances of this passing are 1 to 10?
Not very good.
Zero.
We passed for a number of years after Shelley was in office, a speaker, every year, Assembly Bill number 1, public campaign financing. But it got no traction. There was no support in the Senate. The governor didn't want it. So we stopped doing it. But it's still our position. But I don't think it's going to be happening either.
Well, it's your position, and we have a system. So maybe you could explain it to everybody, called a one-house bill. What is a one-house bill?
A one-house bill is a piece of legislation advanced by a member that may not have a Republican sponsor and therefore cannot get passed in the Senate, or may have a Democratic sponsor that cannot get passed in the Senate. But at times, it is worth having a one-house bill to indicate your position, your philosophical point of view on an issue of public importance. For example, for many years, Pete Granis used to be in the Assembly for Manhattan, had a one-house bill prohibiting smoking indoors. People laughed at him and said, Pete, it's not going to happen. He persisted year after year. We would vote for it. It wouldn't go anyplace. Eventually, he found a Republican sponsor, and it became law. So it's a one-house bill initially. And these things can be transformed with a lot of work and a few prayers to become a bipartisan bill approved by the governor and the law of the state of New York.
What do you think about the press? I ask you this as a guy who's leaving. You know, you might have a different answer than when you were here.
Well, I think you can't generalize too much. Some like yourself, not that you're, because you're in front of me, intelligent, objective, and do a good job. Others on the radio, some radio programs, are clueless. Absolutely make statements that have no basis in fact. People believe them. I also have more respect for the printed media in general. That's why I hate to see less people reading the New York Times, for example, sure, because of the ability of reporters who are on the scene every day, and there are fewer and fewer of those, to give an in-depth analysis of a subject that one doesn't get necessarily on radio news or some of these talk shows.
So how do you filter the good ones from the bad ones? Do you just decide who you'll talk to?
Oh, no, I talk to anybody in general.
Hence, you're here.
Scraping the bottom of the barrel today, but no. But the role of the press is critically important.
Yeah.
And democracy, we need objectivity in reporting, and the more that is reported and written about what we do is important to the electorate and to the process and to the institutions themselves.
Let's talk about hypocrisy for a moment. I want to go back to this example of the Senate. They all signed a bill that said that they would be for an outside commission doing the redistricting. Okay, you've already explained that you don't agree with the whole concept. Nevertheless, they all signed it. And then when, unexpectedly, they won the Senate back, they all disdained it. Don't you think that hurts the credibility of politicians, that kind
of
thing?
Yes, it does. I did not sign that pledge. I do not sign any pledges. Because, one, they're simplistic in a sense. Yes, I will support this bill. I'll sign that pledge. Well, that bill, for example, can be altered and amended. And I have signed a pledge that may go, I have signed a pledge, yet I may support a bill that is a little contrary to the initial bill that was proposed. I don't sign a pledge. But that was blatantly obvious. They signed a pledge on redistricting and very quickly reversed themselves on it. And it's not good for them particularly, or for any of us.
So, Ron Canestrary, we'll consider this your valedictory address here. So my question is,
I'll come back for a fee, but it's
well,
okay.
Yeah, fee, right. But what you have to do is tell us how you would change state government for the better.
Oh, wow. How much time do we have?
At least 7 minutes.
I think we have seen some changes for the better under the leadership of Governor Cuomo, and that sense of leadership from the executive mansion is important. We haven't had that in the last couple of governors. So that has been essential. I do believe that the heart of the matter is public financing of campaigns. I think that is critically important to help change the process, reduce, if not eliminate, the role of money in the political process. And that certainly would be a step in the right direction.
If the Democrats win the Senate, do you think that that would be a situation in which such a bill could pass?
I would hope so. But the last time the Democrats were in control of the Senate 2 years ago, things did not go very well.
It was chaos.
It was chaotic. And we had difficulty getting measures done that we thought would be slam dunk. And even in the regular routine of business, things were tough. But hopefully things would change if it does happen this time around.
There is a new ethics commission that includes both the legislative branch and the executive branch, I believe, for the first time. So is this a good thing?
Yes, it's good, but it's not the ultimate solution. You know, ethics commissions or not, depending on their configuration, most of what tripped up people was not ethical violations as such, but basically criminal law. You know, these things are basic. Bribery, extortion, things of this nature, kickbacks.
Sure.
This is a violation of criminal law. So these things should be punished regardless of, so quote, ethical, close quote, considerations or some commission making a judgment or determination. The errors have been too much more fundamental and glaring than that.
It has been said that the FBI has declared open war on the legislature. Is there any truth to that? You think that
I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so. And no, I don't believe that's true. And I think the things that have happened with some individuals are more driven locally by law enforcement and prosecutors and not from the FBI directly, but I could be wrong on that.
So as part of your valedictory here, what else do you want to see a change?
Well, I think public financing is important. I do think more could be done in the open and in daylight. We're pushing in our house for more televising of proceedings. We have limited public broadcasting of our proceedings. But we want something...
Committee meetings.
Committee meetings, press conferences of all types. And, of course, that can open the door to abuses. That's a problem. But committee meetings and conference committee meetings, things of that nature.
Conference committee meetings? You let the television cameras into the Democratic conference?
No. Conference committee, meaning budgetary conference committees. No. There has to be a time for privacy, too, and a time for us to vent and go crazy.
But doesn't that just shift the locus of decision-making from the floor where everybody says, okay, we're on television, hold up your hand, to the conference where the real decisions are being made?
But it could be that way now, let alone if we televise or not televise. There has to be a time when legislators can get together in private and talk about things, whether you do it 10 or 15 people together in a group or 20 in a group. I want to hear your viewpoint from... you know, the North Country and what you want to think. And I want you to hear my viewpoint from the Capital District without the glare of press, without the glare of publicity, and in a frank exchange, no holds barred discussion. And that's what we have in the Democratic Conference.
The majority leader is the floor leader.
Correct.
What's that like? You sit on the floor, and like a coach on the side of the football field, you have to glare at people, you have to put your hand razor-like across your throat. what's that like to have that kind of power?
It's not that much power. It's been a great position, and one of the things I'm proudest of is the ability to work with Republicans and have our debates and discussions held in a very good setting, not an acrimony. And I've tried to include them in a lot of things. There's less partisanship in the House. I played a role in that, but the Speaker has certainly too. And the leader of the Republicans, Brian Kolb, was a whole different attitude. And we've tried to reduce that.
A whole different from a guy like Jim Tedesco is what you're really saying, yeah.
Yes.
Who takes a shot whenever he can.
Most.
Kolb you find to be more, you know, less confrontational and more willing to work together.
And knows when to take the shots and when it's productive. They've gained seats in our House. Mm-hmm. And the strategy that Brian Kolb has employed has worked for them. But it's also worked on a larger scale in our House to have the debates flow. They're still acrimonious at times and difficult. But there's a time for politicking, a time for electioneering, and there's a time not. And there's a greater awareness of that than we've ever seen before in the Assembly.
Ron Cacciari, have you ever punished anybody for misbehaving on the floor?
No.
Politically?
No.
Moved his office down to the basement, anything like that?
No. I wouldn't do that. It's not my power to do it to begin with. I wouldn't recommend it, nor would I be a part of it.
Yeah. I am so envious of your decision. I think you're a great man. I always have. And the ability to make a decision like this can't come easy. Got to keep you up at night.
No, it was difficult for a number of months until I made the decision. I don't like indecision. So the decision being made, you move on, and I think it's the right one for me at this particular point in time.
Okay, we only have a minute left. And when you walked into Shelley's office, Shelley Silver, the Speaker, and said, Shelley, I've made a decision here, what was his reaction?
I hear you.
He's great. We hope that now that you're a free man, that you'll come in here at WAMC and do some commentaries from us from time to time.
For whatever it's worth.
And give us some insights into the way that it works and give us color commentary and the rest of it. It's just been a pleasure knowing you up to now, and we hope that there'll be many more years.
I hope so, too. Thank you, Alan.
The Capital Connection is distributed with the cooperation of the public radio stations of New York State. Ian Pickus is producer of The Capital Connection, a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio in Albany. Support for The Capital Connection comes from New York State United Teachers, representing professionals in education and healthcare online at nysut.org. And NISCASA, the New York State Coalition Against Sexual Assault, working to support men in their decisions to end sexual violence with the My Strength Is Not For Hurting campaign, online at nyscasa.org.